You're listening to a nerdy production.
Warning, this is a nerdy production. Welcome into the GM Workshop. My name is Jacob, and my mission in this podcast is to dig up tacit knowledge about role-playing games so we can be better GMs and create great stories, great moments around the table as a GM. And I will try to bring you episodes each Wednesday, plus reviews, action play podcasts, and maybe some bonus episodes coming up your way. Reach out to us on the GM Workshop at Facebook, Twitter, and Discord, and subscribe to the podcast in any podcast app you are using. And now, on to today's episode.
Roll for initiative.
Welcome to the GM Workshop. Welcome inside. Today we are talking Infinity. It's a role-playing game from Modiphius, and with me again is Frank, who also was on my episode with the Conan RPG from Modiphius, and he is a pretty experienced GM back when, before I was born, almost. So he has a lot of weight on his shoulders. But with me also is Nils, my co-host from the Danish podcast and the Danish version of the podcast, but also in some of the English. Both of them are in my earlier episodes, my Conan episode with Frank for a few weeks ago, and Nils of the first episodes when we changed to the English version. So if you want to check up on those credentials on the... So we will jump into a talk about Infinity from Modiphius. So guys and Frank, let's start with you. What is the draw for you in this setting?
Yeah, Infinity has become my favorite 2D20 RPG. Although I have to say, at first I was a little bit skeptical about the setting, what would be interesting in that, because I knew Mutant Chronicles. Mutant Chronicles is an awesome setting, and it draws you right in. It's retro sci-fi and lots of action. And Infinity seemed to be, usually cannot play aliens that much. There's not much psionics, which you find in many science fiction RPGs. So what's there? There's lots of equipment. It's so weird. And then I started reading into the setting background a bit, and I didn't come from the miniatures game, so I didn't know a thing about that. And this setting has such an awesome background, an awesome not so near future development, about 175 currently in the miniatures game, about 180 years into the future setting, which is very unique in so many ways. It's a very fresh and refreshing kind of take of such a near or not so near future setting, and that drew me in. It's more the setting than the rules. It's more the ideas that went into this setting, and that makes you simply want to play there in very different regions and very different characters. So this became actually my favorite 2D20 role-playing game.
Yeah, and there's a lot. You've, as I said before, the Conan RPG, you have... Deputos into that a lot, and as also a player and a GM. So you have a lot of experience with the 2D20 family of systems. So Nils, you did you? I know you played the miniature game, but what was this your first experience with Infinity universe or setting?
I thought about playing the miniature war game actually.
I've
been role playing for way longer, but I got drawn in by it because I am a giant Ghost in the Shell fan, guilty as charged. And the setting pays homage to those ideas of post cyberpunk so many times over that it was really, really easy to get invested in. What draws me in is the fact that it is post cyberpunk, but it meshes that with a lot of futuristic optimism at the same time. So if you imagine you take Ghost in the Shell and then you take a spray can of glitter and you spray it on top of it, you've got the Infinity setting. I'm exaggerating, but it the same way Exalted does, it takes a base outline setting, and then they go, okay, how many things can we think of that are cool, and how do we fit them on the map?
Yeah.
As opposed to Exalted, it does so over a galaxy. Well, a number of planetary systems, so they don't end up stepping on each other's toes all the time.
Yeah. So you started with the miniature game, right?
Yes.
Yes. And then you found a group in our local community here and tried the Infinity role playing game, and then you were hooked in even more. Why this version of a cyberpunk sci-fi setting for you?
Well, first of all, it's a broad setting. You can do a lot with it. If you try to play other versions of cyberpunk, then you end up with, like, I don't know, Shadowrun. That tends to describe one city that it focuses on. You could be elsewhere, but it's about Detroit. This setting insists that it will do a lot more concepts, but it will spread them out. So geographically, you pick your setting. If you want to I want to be pseudo Rambo in a jungle full of werewolves, we have a planet for that. That was awfully specific, I know. but I have never actually played that. I should sometime. But but it explores a very, very wide breadth of concepts that it then also manages to actually tie together in a meaningful manner. Where if you want to do this kind of grand science fiction with, say, the alien system, you have a lot of legwork to do.
Yeah, for sure.
It's interesting that my usual pitch for new players is it's actually cyberpunk without the punk. So it's not a depressing world. It's not a world where everything is going to hell and you go with it. It's a sci-fi optimistic setting. Things get better. Technology actually helps people. Of course it presents problems. And there are those weird, reckless scientists who experiment on things men are not meant to do. And of course there's some kind of alien menace but the alien menace, the invasion of the combined army, this is actually a thing, of course, to cause some external conflict, and there's lots of inner strife in the human sphere. The thing is, it's worth fighting for to keep things going. It has so many positive aspects, and people want to keep that. It's not like in cyberpunk where everything is rotten, and why would you actually fight for anything like that? It will all go to hell sooner or later, probably sooner. So there's no future, and that's the punk aspect. And Infinity doesn't have that. Of course, there are ATACs, so people who are denying the use of modern technology, but still, it's a post-scarcity society where you get your basic income, which is a topic that is very currently discussed in many, many countries, and you have social security, you have the ability to actually decide what you want to do with your life, and people do things, interesting things, and that's an opportunity that is so intriguing. I find that really, really draws me in.
That's the glitter, right? I tend to say that in the Aleph expansion book, there is a quote they have taken called "The Unbearable Lightness of Being," how meaning breaks down when you meet no challenges anymore. And they've taken that as a headline, and then they have changed it to "The Bearable Lightness of Being," and talk about how post-humans and other people who live forever, how they manage that, and how it does not resolve in utter pointlessness. That feels like a very Infinity moment.
You can compare that to cyberpunk. You can compare Infinity to other games like the Expanse RPG, like Ghost in the Shell. There's of course some RPG adaptations for that, and of course with other games like Cowboy Bebop, there's an RPG Kickstarter coming next year, I think, and of course with Eclipse Phase. Eclipse Phase is transhumanism, which is a topic for Infinity too. But Eclipse Phase is transhumanism cranked to 11. So you get a weird zoo of weirdos, and this is much more reduced, much more manageable in Infinity. You might get that, especially on the mothership Bakunin, But still, most of the folks there are normal people. You can easier relate to playing a normal human being than to play some kind of intelligent toaster or some totally artificial being without anybody or so. That's Eclipse Phase makes it a bit harder to get into the characters.
Yeah. I like your point to emphasize that this is a upward spiral instead of a downward spiral that we see a lot in a lot of other sci-fi games, even Expanse role-playing games. And I just talked to the Dead in Space guys from the Stockholm Syndicate and Cartel, and they were the setting of Dead in Space is pretty pretty gloomy and not very positive in any regards. So I like your points on taking this setting into another direction than other sci-fi and other cyberpunk-ish settings are doing it. Also in Shadowrun we have the evil dragons and the evil corpse that are consuming the world, and in cyberpunk it's a bit of the same, just without dragons. But as you pointed out, I like that point a lot. And one of the draws for me in Infinity is for sure that it's more glitter, as you said, but not too much glitter. It's not My Little Pony glitter, but it's great. It's a great point, guys, for sure.
Yeah, I like to say that something like Altered Carbon, if anybody's familiar with the television series, it's too bad it never got a second season. but that could
be perfectly right. Damn shame.
We ignore the bad spin-off they made.
But there was the anime that was kind of okay. But anyway, that could easily play out in the Infinity Universe. Because Altered Carbon strikes the same balance that the world is progressing, things are getting better. But of course, rich guys are still assholes, and the main character is still screwed, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And Infinity definitely does that, especially if you look for it in the setting. It's there in a lot of different ways. And I think we will end up talking about archetypes later on, because they lean very heavily on those. And then sometimes they twist them and it gets really weird. But we'll get to that.
We get to the systems and more details in it. Just to open the conversation where why this setting is so great for you guys, for sure. When I dive into this to be prepared to talk with you, the detail level in this setting was astounding. I didn't have enough time in my life to give all the details the notice they should have, and for me, some of the problems with a lot of settings out there are that there are too much stuff. Is the details in this setting is so great. How to use these details? How are you when you are GMing? I know Nils, you are not GMing this a lot, but you are pretty deep inside this setting anyway. But Frank, how do you use the detail level with your players to help them understand all the nitty-gritty things in this setting, because there's a lot.
This is another thing I like with the Infinity setting, and it's actually one of the main problems with the Infinity settings too. It has the same thing like Lorantha or other settings that are very detailed in their description. You have to pick a certain region to start and a certain amount of details to start your player characters with, because it's such a vastly not only detailed but networked setting background. So you read in one source book some nice little detail. In the next source book you see, oh, that's the other viewpoint on the same detail, and the whole situation looks different. This is hard to convey in a role-playing game, but of course it helps you have player characters. And player characters in Infinity are created by using a life path system. So those details of the setting background actually influence the characters right from the start. So you have a character with some allies or some rivals in some factions. They have some events that had happened. They participated maybe in a war during first offensive on Paradiso or so. They have their backstory. And that is the starting point where you inject the necessary details to give the characters a good feeling that they belong to a real world, and they act like real persons in that world. But you simply cannot just dump everything on the player characters. That no. doesn't work. So you have to choose and pick. And this is, of course, we will talk about that, how to start a group and how to start a campaign. You have to make choices. Mm-hmm. You have to pick the things you want to concentrate on, and you cannot give all details in one go. That doesn't work.
You don't have players like Nils in your group all the time, so I know everybody about the settings. So,
I'd like to say at this point, I don't think anybody knows everything about the setting anymore.
No.
Because the Modifius guys sort of had a tiger by the tail when they had to do this, because mm-hmm. it was all funded by Kickstarter initially, and it got through quite a few stretch goals, let's just say, and that meant extra supplementary books. And then for the writing process, they wrote something, and then Corvus Belli, who owns the property, proofread it and gave feedback, and then they had a back and forth, and then finally books were ready, and then they were proofread and then published.
Mm-hmm.
This means that even though the Kickstarter ended, I don't know, in 2016? I can't recall.
15. It's now 7 years that they are in the fulfillment.
Yes. And at this point, they have actually written to those of us who went completely bananas and backed it on the highest tier that they're not going to manage to proofread the last three books. They're going to publish them, but there are going to be mistakes in them. And when I flip through some of the supplements, there are very, very egregious mistakes that their reliance on free proofreading just didn't catch. So you have entire tables with gibberish headlines or sentences that don't make sense, but that nobody caught in time.
About that, I'd like to inject something. They only gave about a week to read through the preview PDFs for the backers to send in their feedback to make some corrections or so. This is not enough. So having a week's time, I just barely managed to get through the HyperCorps book, and that has lots of errors. Even 2 weeks would have been better, but maybe 4 weeks or so. I feel the last few books were rushed. The technology book is a copy-paste job with all the errors, which sucks, of course, too. And the thing is, I wish they would have taken a little bit more time. I don't know if their license is running out, if the time is running out, because Mutant Chronicles will end with the end of this month, is the Mutant Chronicles license gone. This is a disservice to the backers. And I know Infinity is for Modifius not the most lucrative product line, and it's probably quite a pain in the ass for Modifius staff to actually get rid of all those financed Kickstarter books they have to release. But yeah, that's a thing. Do it right, and don't screw things up. So I'm a little bit disappointed about the last few books.
If I had to guess as to the reasoning, and this is pure speculation, then I would say it might actually be a bottleneck on Corvus Belli's end, because their next Kickstarter introducing their fantasy campaign comes out this year.
Yeah, of course. They have started a whole new genre, and have their staff, of course, working on that. And of course, Modifius is not a company with numerous employees, so they do have their other product lines, especially Star Trek and Dune and other things that are probably going much, much better than Infinity. Infinity is quite an acquired taste and not a thing that is very well known before, and it wasn't advertised that much, actually.
Yeah, and the detail level in the setting are one of the bottlenecks, I presume, because there's a lot of from the war game and from the board game that you have played a lot, Nils, what is called?
It's just called Infinity.
Yeah, it's your Infinity board game, the dungeon crawler.
Oh, that's called Defiance, yeah.
Defiance, yeah. That's the dungeon crawler. And there's Aristea, a kind of dueling board game.
I guess it's Speedball with guns.
Yeah. So there's a lot of details that you guys were, when you were backing it back in the days, Nils, you wanted all, but then they might realize that the quality couldn't be upheld, or as you said, the license might run out soon or something like that. I don't know anything about that, so you can
talk
about it later, maybe.
I'm not privy to Modiphius's inner workings, but no. It's certainly become a bottleneck, not just for the players, but for the actual production of the setting.
Yeah, you saw that in the sequence of Kickstarters. They started Mutant Chronicles, of course, first, and Infinity was the second Kickstarter project. And the third one was Conan. And I had the impression that even though Infinity was quite a success with Kickstarter, at least regarding their stretch goals and the whole finance sum, but Conan was more prominent. And I had the impression they drew some of the development stuff also to Conan because it's much more important, and then they acquired the Star Trek license, and all of a sudden, even in the Conan books, those folks who worked in Conan and produced good quality source books disappeared, showed up in the Star Trek books, and the last few Conan source books had a decline in quality too. So yeah, that's what you do if you only have a few persons who are very capable. You have to put them on the most lucrative projects. That's fine. I can understand that. It's still lamentable.
Yeah, that's it's too bad to take too big of a bite out of this setting, and they might should focus on a great few books and not that many. So,
regarding that, yeah. I'd like to add if you only have the core book, that's about 550 pages or so. That should actually be enough to play for decades, because it's such a wealth of information about the setting. You can basically create all characters you like. There are some very specific character types, but those are easily produced as a kind of instance of existing career types and so on. And lots of equipment, so you can actually make your own and design your own. You can design your own vehicles and so on. So the core book is actually a very, very useful and complete thing. That's a thing you rarely find in many other games. So I can recommend, if you want to start, the core book will suffice for long campaigns.
But the detail level in that book alone are... Yeah, it's a lot to dive into for GM and Nils. If you should start a new group with this in this setting, how would you approach this?
Okay, it depends on where we're playing in the world, but generally speaking, you need to apply the fog of war or the fog of information warfare. This is a futuristic setting where I'm tempted to call it social media, but. The access to Aleph, the internet parallel in this world, completely controls your perception of reality. There are parts of the setting where war criminals are reprogrammed via social media to be brain dead zombies that will be sent out to die for the motherland, the weird Chinese nation. So the power of that sphere is very, very profound. So what I would do with a new player is I would run through the life path system. Then I would make sure the life path system hasn't screwed over my campaign, because it can do that. We should get back to that under the rules. But help them make reasonable characters, and then try to explain to them how the world looks for their character, because that is a manageable job. Explaining how the world looks for the GM is not.
You can't
do that to a new player in an evening. It doesn't work.
Yep. Your player character is your window into the setting, and so how your player character perceives the setting, that's the most important thing. Any information that is doesn't play a role on the gaming table is not so important. It's only facts in small print, but all capital facts, it's only what you actually use in your game at your table. That's important.
Yeah, and that's a good point to find these, it's the truth in a lot of settings, and use the player's perception into the settings parameters for sure, and make sure that you have some kind of idea where the characters are, as you said, Nils, in the life path system that doesn't screw your basic idea of the campaign over, but also have an idea where you can link in information so the players, through NPCs or through contacts or through the setting as in general, to make them more comfortable in the setting so they know more and can help you create a great story with you.
And you have to decide, of course, in the first place, if you want to run a freeform campaign, like a sandboxy thing, maybe with a group of mercenaries or a group of traders or whatever you actually might have, or if you want to run one of the pre-made campaigns. And there are a few rather lengthy campaigns available. They are released in the last few years, and some shorter adventure collections where you can mix and match, and some mid-length campaigns. So if you want to run pre-made campaigns, they won't fit for every kind of character that's possible, of course. This is a decision you have to make before that, before they even create a character. So if you run, for example, the what's it called, a Quantronic Heat campaign, it's only a three-part mid-length campaign. You know, the player characters are supposed to work for O12, which is a Bureau Noir O12, which is a kind of secret service of the so-called kind of United Nations in the future, in the human sphere. And the player characters act as special agents, as operatives there, so they get a mission. This would be totally different if you have kind of freelancer campaign where they have to seek out their own objectives and seek out their own missions. But in this case, you can direct them in a certain way, and you should do that. You should make sure that your mix of characters sent on this mission is actually working for this campaign. So it really depends. Do you want to run pre-made things? Do you want to run your own? Do you want to mix and match, which always works? It's a hard decision, and you have to talk with your players, and you have to feel comfortable with things in the setting you like to run. So that's my usual approach. So what do I want to run? And then I talk to the players second.
Yeah, there's always the problem with such a big setting, and especially when we're talking sci-fi, as you said, Nils, there is you can build any scenario into this setting or system. You're hunting werewolf in a jungle or corporate espionage in a metropole city kind of thing. There's a lot of options for players, so it's a huge setting. So as a GM, you have to, especially new in the setting, you have to guide your players or make a meter contract with your players that we are okay, guys. We are only playing in on this jungle. You are not supposed to go into your spaceship and fly to the biggest city and go explore there. It's on this jungle planet. Today is Friday. Today is on the jungle planet. Next Friday I can prepare something else. So make these contracts with your players when you have such a huge setting. I have played a lot of Star Wars, and the same issue comes up there, especially if you want to go more sandboxy on the Star Wars setting, because they can fly anywhere. They can fly to the center of the universe in Coruscant or to Tatooine or whatever, and the system, the play patterns are different in all over the place. So use this huge setting with your players and not go sandbox from beginning, I presume.
System does something really interesting to mitigate this.
Yes.
But it requires that the GM have read most of the setting, most of the books, frankly, in order to do it. Infinity is built originally to facilitate Black Ops operations. That's how the miniature war game started. It's what the Dungeon Crawler does. And to some extent, it is the assumed fiction. You can then work for a company or a nation state, or you can be mercenaries. That's what you expect them to do, and that leans towards the shadow punky, cyberpunky style of play, right? Because you get to see beneath the surface of what the different nations are doing and participate in their conflicts.
But although you're working for the man in this case, you're working for the government and not as cyberpunk, where you're working against everyone in power. So this is quite different, because you can always pull your O12 credentials and simply take over the case or something. You have this kind of power, which makes any kind of secret mission obvious, so that could ruin the whole mission, but still, you have the power.
Yeah, you can absolutely ruin yourself by telling who you work for. but if you don't want to do that, and you say, I want to play a mercenary company, and I want to do a space pirates campaign, then the GM who's read the setting immediately goes, well, then we need the Hack Islam book, because there it has rules for being a space pirate.
Yeah.
If you want to play the corporate, the hyperpowers, you want to play the corporate game, then there's the book for that. If you want to focus on the tech side, of so the high-tech world, there's admittedly not very good, but book for that, and so on. So you make this decision because these modules, these systems, are not compatible with each other. You can't, I mean, I guess you could try, but it would be rules-wise really awkward to try and play a corporation who is also space pirates. The dice system simply do not work together.
Well, if you do space pirating right, you become a corporation, or else you are not only a minor version of that. If you do it right, you do it as a corporation.
Yeah, there's two options. As a pirate, either you die or you'll be a corporation.
Yeah.
But now it seems that you have to decide the kind of campaign. That is true, you can do that. But still, you could start a campaign as a corporate espionage thing and then end up being chased by werewolves through a jungle. Because yes. That's Infinity 2. That happens.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Things go down on a minute's notice, and people find themselves in out of their comfort zone all the time. And it's the human sphere only has 11 planets that are settled. And that doesn't sound that many, but each of them is at least as diverse as Earth. So you have a problem with that. You have a vast amount of space to drop your player characters into, and there are things going on all the time. And I like that you start things in a certain way, and you can introduce as a GM lots of twists. Things end up unexpectedly.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I mean, okay, there are 11 planets, but then you have all of the space stations and the various weird mining colonies that are described. Again, the 550 books of the base, just the base book, does a good job of setting up a lot of this.
Yeah, another problem is, of course, if you compare that, for example, to Mutant Chronicles, where you have some giant corporations, they are usually very localized on certain planets. In Infinity, you have nation-states that encompass several planets. You have, of course, corporations and other factions that are more distributed. So you might actually find yourself on this ice world Svalaheimer and have lots of factions even competing on this single planet.
Yeah.
Especially Svalaheimer, because it's a contested planet with several factions in open war against each other, and companies selling to both sides. So yes, that one is a headache.
and a great plot hook. It seems so. So the fractions. There's a lot of, the human centric part of the setting. There's a lot of factions. And how do we use this in the game? We were touching this ice planet you were talking about, but also the other places in the setting, there's a lot of war between those fractions. How can we help players use them and help GMs to create great stories with the fractions in between? Nils, have you any saying on this?
Definitely. The first thing to realize is that all of the major factions are archetypes, and one thing Infinity does really well is that it fights for all of its archetypes. I cannot point you to a faction and say they're the guys who lose all the time. There isn't a fiction like that. So your perspective on the campaign depends on what faction you go into, and that faction, the perspective you land in, also says a lot about how you see the others. So it's not so much that there's a gazillion factions, there are, but it's that the world is thorough enough that you get a mesh of perspectives, and you get situations made on purpose where those perspectives do not make sense. Where, like, you have a corporation that your faction historically likes, but now they're actually working for the enemy, and it ends up being weird when you realize that's going on. So it is it is believable enough that if you brief your players again on their characters, then they will get the conflict built in, and the archetypes that the factions they're fighting against, I guess, represent, will come for them to represent opposition or evil or whatever it is. A really good example are the two main factions in terms of military power. They are Panosiania, which is a capitalist faction. Everything is run by money, the politicians are owned by money, the mega corporations have as much power as the government in that nation. But at the same time, they are the most wealthy and the most technologically prosperous. Against them, you then have the Empire State of Yujing, which is a very, very orderly society, because it is an empire, it is not a democracy. But they focus a lot on honor, on tradition, on what traditional cultures you come from. Remember, this is 200 years in the future, but people still identify with being of Japanese origin or whatever it is in their state. So there's a lot of especially military pride again, because this began as a war game. But at the same time, of course, they're also the totalitarian government in the system. So what you get is sort of a package deal.
About those factions, they are, of course, there's not always war amongst those factions, because that would destroy humanity. And it's not only Aleph as the AI that takes care of keeping conflicts manageable. The neo-colonial wars in the setting, they had been of massive destructive effect on the upcoming civilizations there. And so that was toned down, but conflicts still happen, but on a smaller scale, which is tolerated by the somewhat benevolent AI. But the thing is, of course, even in a single faction, you find lots of sub-factions. For example, the Yuting example. Yeah, they present as a kind of empire, more like the Chinese empire, but still they have a party, only one, a single party. And inside the party, you have two different factions, some more progressive, some more conservative. And all those are competing with each other. They are using their different power plays to gain the upper hand, and they have, as Yuting has a lot of planets colonized, they have a double planet system which are in the habitable zone, so they have actually two fully settled planets. They have lots of Asian origin minorities there, which are treated as you would expect from modern day China extrapolated into the future, which means there's some unrest and some not so happy feelings about their treatment. And this is, of course, taken up in the miniatures game with the uprising event of the Japanese, who actually gained in the timeline independence. And that those things are happening in all those factions. You have in every single faction, even in the smaller ones, you have some strife, because humans are humans. They want to do their thing, they have their groups, they have their ideas, and want to promote them, and things are changing. And this is what drew me in. It's a very plausible extrapolation of a kind of future history, and it takes up very human ideas, human feelings, and human methods to promote their ideas. We learn from history that history does repeat itself in for good and bad, and those major factions, they do make their mistakes, of course, and they suffer for it. And this makes it more plausible as a future history than I think the typical idealized and very very coarse grained, very broad brushstroke sci-fi history you often get. This is much more finely detailed, And I really like that.
Yeah, you can set some lines to our real world, and therefore they can dive into the conflicts in China, as you said, or in Russia, or in the EU, or something like that, and try to find why are we fighting now? That's the reason we are fighting in the future as well. Find these overlaps. That's pretty cool. A cool point for sure, Frank.
Role-playing game lives from stereotypes and from cliches, and you take political stereotypes, conflict stereotypes, and extrapolate them into the future, and that makes it much more believable as a kind of development.
Yeah, and another thing to understand, and this, I was reading the setting for a while, I think a few years during the miniature war games before I realized this in earnest. The developers are invested in making sure that the factions make sense. So the Yujing State Empire, the Chinese guys, do brainwash criminals and make them frontline soldiers. And yes, the population cheers when they get gunned down. And there are some very, very dark themes there. But at the same time, if you then go in and read why do they do this, it's because they need that manpower, because they don't have the technological advantage in open conflict with Panoceania or its ersatz companies that they act through. So they need that, and they're afraid that if they can't keep up, then Panoceania's culture will develop. They will develop a monopoly. So you've got a culture war going on, and that is then used to justify some of all these things and some of the war crimes against the Japanese, who, by the way, when they declared independence, were of course funded by the blue capitalists. Because why wouldn't they be?
it's like today. You have your wars that are used like puppets. Minor nations used like puppets by the major players. This is happening today. This will happen in the future. It happened in history all the time. And the interesting thing is. Usually, role-playing games are developed, of course, in the United States, as the biggest market, the origin of role-playing games, and you often see a very US-positive view on the future. And this is not the case with Infinity, and not with Mutant Chronicles 2. So you have both settings are from a very European perspective, Mutant Chronicles from the Swedish perspective, and Infinity from the Spanish perspective, and this is so refreshing. You don't get the stereotypical U.S. will save the world and the universe. No, it's a total different kind of take into the future, and this is I think it's a very fresh take on that.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, knows.
One last thing I want to point out about the setting, because I was really nervous when I ran into this originally. There is a grand neo-Muslim empire in the setting.
Yeah, yeah.
And if this was an American sort of stereotypical setting, then all of my alarm bells would be going off. But they sat down. They actually recently changed their faction logo. That's probably not reflected in the roleplay books, because they didn't want some of the connotations of the Arabic scripture on the faction symbol. But whatever. They went out of their way to make it a movement of enlightenment and science. So these people are the specialists in biology and human welfare and extending lifespans and these kinds of things.
They turned the whole Islamic viewpoint around totally on its head. So it's now very science positive, very tolerant for all other religions, very much of seeking of knowledge and not simply knowing what's true. This is the total opposite of what you would expect in a kind of Islamic world. But they do have, of course, the traditional Islamic countries there still. So they have both.
Yeah. And of course, there's a secret army of assassins called Hassassins, because...
Which not always does what the government of the Hakislam faction does want. They have their own goals and their own viewpoints of what's good and what's bad.
Yeah, I think there's a great point those about the Muslim fraction in this setting. It's kind of a preparation could very easily be a problem in this, but I think they did a really good job in trying to figure out how does a religious Islam focused group look in the future and find out how it and still be respectful around another culture that we don't know anything about in so many ways. So I think they were, they did a pretty good job in that.
Some aspects of Ottoman Enlightenment thought and these things.
Yeah, yes.
I'm not an expert on the Muslim world by any stretch, but I was just nervous when I saw it originally and was like, oh shit.
They picked up the Christian and Judeo-Christian world with the Neo-Vatican, the Neo-Christianity there. Yeah. Yes. That of course used lots of tropes that you know and relate to the historical Vatican, of course. But they removed that, of course, onto another planet. They have the Holy Orders, the Order Knights. So you have your kind of people going medieval in power armor against opponents.
Yeah.
So
this
is, of course, a trope for science fiction games, especially the inspiration of Infinity. There had been some Appleseed and other anime things as inspiration. So you have guys in power armor with swords. That has to be a trope. You find that here too. So it's, of course, it's stupid, but still, they have that.
Yes, and no. It's if you ever played the board game, then you'll realize that they have these swords and they're really dangerous, but you never really use them because you have a machine gun. So why would you?
Yeah. Of course, they not it's only not have Doom. Their swords. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not Doom.
Exactly.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you try to take cultures from real Earth and extrapolate them into the future, we have lots of different religious systems and philosophical systems, and they actually managed to build upon them, especially regarding the philosophical systems with the nomad motherships. You have three huge, immense motherships. That are like floating space stations, but movable, of course. And you have in each of them very different outlook on society, how society works and how it's supposed to work. And this is actually a kind of test bed for all sorts of weird socio-economic ideas. And on Bakunin, you find all of them and then some.
Yeah, for sure.
But if we're moving on to talk about our ideas, then there's a lot going on there as well.
Separate. We can touch on ideas and tech because Nils is a tech geek and a philosopher major from the university, so he has a lot of saying about that. But to round this this fraction talk up, if our listeners want to know more about my view on preparation and the podcast preparation, we have episode 11 only on preparation, so I'm not unaware of the issues surrounding this, so check that out for sure.
Regarding the setting, I would say it's hard to actually get a grasp of the setting in such a talk as we are doing that, but there are a few YouTube videos where they present the setting with the factions and lots of the illustrations from the books. So I can recommend taking a look at those. They give you in about 20 minutes or so a good rundown of the whole setting, and due to the visual aspects of the art, which is actually quite great in the miniature war game books and in the role playing game books, at least the first few two. This gives you a good view, an actual view of how things look like in Infinity, which is pretty unique.
Yeah, for sure. So the tech part of this huge setting is one of the draws for me, and I know for you, Nils, and also for you, Frank. Is there any space magic? I can't remember. I'm sorry, I haven't read it all.
yes, there is.
There is some fringe space magic as well, but it's primary tech we are interlean into when we are talking the systems or the settings weirdness or not our world preferences. So the tech how did this how is this different from other sci-fi settings, especially Nils?
I think first and foremost, let's just settle the space magic thing.
Yeah. Okay.
There are two things in the setting that they haven't tried to call technology. Well, kind of. There's an alien race called the Toha, which manipulate things via pheromones, which allows them to breed other artificial races that they control. And how that works is not explained, because the Toha haven't deigned to share it, and no, you cannot play a Toha character.
It's so real, it doesn't matter.
So that's as close to space magic as you get on that front. And then the other aliens have something called voodoo tech, which is just a catch-all term for technology that is so advanced that we no longer understand it. And of course, as you know, when technology is advanced enough, it'll seem like magic. So that's where we are at on space magic.
The boomstick.
Explanation of how, for example, a cube where you could store your personality or so actually works, and if that is an actual feasible thing to even imagine. This is a setting where you can switch bodies and you can store your personality. This is a priori set. That works. Don't ask too much about that. There are a few things. Wormholes are used for travel between the solar systems. This is another thing. You must simply accept that they exist and they work, because else it wouldn't work at all.
But at least they have made sure that the humans in the setting don't know how it works either. There are entire plot points about wormholes collapsing and humanity just standing around going, so that happened. Shit.
I like that technology is not always reliable. You have advantages due to technology. You have problems that technology actually causes, and you get new problems with every new aspect of technology. You always get new problems. So due to the different conflicts that had been going on, for example, there have nano machines been released, which didn't switch off as planned. So you have lots of problems with those. So be careful, especially on some backwaters planet like Ariadne, Dawn, where you have whole clouds of those. So you have reckless use of technology and the fallout of that. And I like that too, because sometimes your player characters will encounter that or have to clean up the mess others caused.
Another thing that's interesting is that while it's not always explained how the technology works, because if they could do that, they should probably just get the Nobel Peace Prize for everything ever, because that would have meant that they had invented immortality to begin with. It's not explained how it works, because science fiction never really does that. It is explained who controls it and what the logistical routes are and what happens if they are disrupted for a lot of it. Which is a weird plot point to really think is important. But I find it immensely satisfying that even on Optanium, which is called TCM in this setting.
Oh, God, yeah. No, the thing is, I'm a chemist by study. Of course, I work in IT for the last few decades, but I studied chemistry. And people coming up with all new elements all the time, no, you don't. The tesium, nesium, and other neo materials they are called. This is a thing I have to simply swallow without protest. It's important, of course. But still, it's not so much scientifically well founded, to say the least.
No. But it belongs in the setting because effort has been expended to explain. How do we extract it, and why is it rare, and why does it only grow on Dawn? Don't ask the chemist, it doesn't make sense. Moving on.
Yeah.
But it becomes important for the settings, because again, this began as a game of shadow operations. So small crack teams fighting for resources. So they've spent a lot of time explaining what those resources are and how you can fuck up the supply lines.
And of course, there are other resources. So we have this Tisium, which is a kind of... let's call it metal or so, that makes weapons much more effective, but it's important for the whole hacking topic, because it allows the quantronic systems to work. So regular computing systems wouldn't be as effective without the tisium. It's a very rare resource. You need it for weapons, you need it for space flight to actually stabilize your warp hole Minotaur motors, they are called. And of course, you need it for the whole Quantronic network, for your artificial intelligence and so on. So this is very important. And then there's Silk, only found in a very small region on Burak, the homeworld of the Hakislam faction. And they won't tell you what it is, and they won't give it to anyone else to synthesize that. So this is important to actually create your artificial bodies, to create your replacement limbs, to create your cubes, and so on. It's not very well explained what that actually is. It's a natural material, much like a little bit like spice on Dune or so. You need it. It's very important for the whole humanity to work. And it's very rare. And of course, there's lots of criminal stuff going on around that.
Yeah. The entire concept of a grey market in Infinity is just about trade in silk. And there's a... of course, there is a Silk Road trade, because they had to make that joke.
I like that. I like that a lot.
That's the main supplier of silk going out from Borak and then around the 11 or the 10 other planets, I suppose. No, it's never really explained what it is, but it is explained how far Hakislam will go to keep the secret. So, secret laboratories that try to pick silk apart and find out what it is, they end up kind of dead suddenly.
So the space magic part of let's wind back to that, because you have some pheromones in an alien race, and you have some high tech thing in another race, and then you have some. Obtainium, new elements that does not exist when you are a chemist, as you are, Frank. So that's the space magic part. But there is no psionic powers, as we said in the beginning, like you said, Frank. There are no the Force. There's no something like that. So it's more hard science with a lot of too much science, if you can.
Not only science in the sense of natural science like physics, chemistry, biology, but mm-hmm. Psychology too. If you take a look at the whole cyborg abilities, this is actually a social conflict system that does work, and it works exceedingly well, I find. In many, many other games, you find some social conflict things that are very abstract systems or subsystems, or they are simply like hitting someone's hit points away, social hit points, mental hit points or so. This is not that. You create here so-called metanoia effects. That means you cyber attacks like coercing someone or negotiating with someone. Those are not mind control powers. It's not the Jedi mind trick or so. So you gradually shift the viewpoint of your counterpart, and that makes it much more plausible. You know, Jedi mind trick, those are not the remotes you're looking for. This is one thing that could work, but not in Infinity. In Infinity, you might actually switch some kind of perception or so more gradually. And I like how that is set up due to rules mechanics. So the cyborg thing is not mind control, but yeah, it's a social combat where you can actually inject some psychological facts that are well known today and some ideas that could work, but that are not that proven as of yet.
Yeah.
So I can't even imagine how a conspiracy theorist does that in that time.
Oh
my God. Fighting conspiracy theorists on the Facebook is hard, not enough job.
One of the most vicious technologies in the entire setting, this is voodoo techs and stuff the aliens do, is a weapon that shoots you and in real time hacks your personality to think the alien is your friend.
Yeah,
that's nice.
This is a very insidious kind of weapon, and that's one of the few ways of actually losing your player character. Because you might die in the game, but if your cube is saved, you might actually get a new body. If you're a player character, of course, you're probably as valuable for the whole universe that they will resurrect you. But if your personality got hacked, yeah, you're screwed.
Yeah.
And actually, you go from being you might be worth saving to we will shoot you if we see you.
Yeah, sure.
You become the enemy, and you're convinced that being the enemy is the best and right thing to do. But I have to add, I recently read the Combined Army source book, and the Combined Army, especially the Evolved Intelligence, the other artificial intelligence that is clashing with the human sphere. It's not all bad, actually. It's the evolved intelligence allows freedom for their participants, for their subjected nations. They actually, some of them are actually prospering quite a bit. The only thing it demands is to obey, which is not so far away from what Yuzing is actually doing, or Aleph is doing. So, can you really trust Aleph as a benevolent AI? Is it really benevolent?
I feel
do
like
the nomads have the nomads right?
I feel like I'm speaking with a nomad player here.
Yeah. No. I prefer Pan-Oceania, actually.
Cool. So, guys, the verdict, is this a hard sci-fi or space opera? From 1 is high sci-fi and 10 space opera, where will you land on this scale?
It's 7.5.
7.5 for space opera. Okay.
Yep.
Well, what about you, Frank?
I would say 6 or so.
It's, 6. Okay.
It depends on how far you want to go. Due to the rules system, the 2D20 system is a more cinematic system.
Yeah.
It's not a very gritty system. It could be in some cases, but so player characters are big damn heroes. They are very resilient. They can survive things other people probably won't. So that makes it more geared towards high action things. They can get away with things normal people won't do. But still, the plausibility of the setting, the suspension of disbelief, this is very important here. The setting strength is that you're drawn into it and act like a normal person would in this setting. So that makes it a little bit more hardish. But it's still more action. It's a role-playing game for entertainment, so it's action.
Yeah, basically agreed. Yeah. I will add that there are some elements of the rule system that if you choose to lean into them can break you very hard in the direction of space opera, and that's why I say 7.5.
Yeah.
For instance, money is handled in an abstract manner, and if you power game having a lot of money, oh dear God.
This is what would be one thing that what could be better. The acquisition system is a good idea, but it needs some fixing.
players who don't abuse it, I think.
So at 6.5 in the verdict from Frank and Nils. Looking at Infinity, how to construct a group or a play group, what would you bring to a table for this, Frank? If you want to run a not a sandboxy campaign, but a pretty wide campaign, and you have some plot points and you have some meta plot fleshed out, but how do you want to construct a group in this?
That's the hardest question, because if I were to run one of the pre-made campaigns, for example the Shadow Affair campaign, this is like Apocalypse Now on Paradiso. So you get ordered to serve as O12 usually, O12 agents in one of the camps, the military camps in Paradiso, and things go to hell. This is like Predator plus Apocalypse Now plus other things that you might imagine in the wartime setting. This is war. War is hell, and the planet Paradiso is even more hell than Australia. So everything in Australia tries to kill you, and on Paradiso it will kill you twice. So this is not a nice surrounding. You would create a much different character group, and I would recommend player characters to go for careers that enhance their survivability. So no pencil pusher characters or so. They will probably die very, very soon. So this wouldn't fit. And of course, O12 wouldn't send some people who are very good at analyzing some finances or so, some economists into a military camp. On the other hand, if you play a very different campaign, for example, the Quantronic Heat, that starts with a kind of corporate espionage thing going on in a very delicate sector of military technology research. And you can simply put your group of investigators there. So people who have some social skills, some investigative skills, hacking or so, probably not so much combat oriented as you need for this wartime Paradiso campaign. So it really depends on what do you want to run regarding the whole theme of the campaign. And so investigative campaigns, different characters, your trader campaign, you can easily have space traders, like in Traveler with the typical free trader thing going on, totally different characters. So, and due to the vastness of the setting, that makes it, for me, the hardest question to even start a campaign. I have to come with ideas what I do want to run. And then I talk to my players what they want to play. But you need to actually frame your campaign in a certain way that you know what you want to run.
Cool. Nils, how did you, when you were playing, you were a player in a group, how did you manage, or how you did your GM manage this to make a great group so you can work together? Did he have a meta plot, or did, how did you construct the group and make sure all had their arenas and their tech and the all the things lined up?
There was a meta plot in place, so we did not play O12 agents, but actually mercenaries who did not have a secret bench. but so we sat down and we decided what spaceship we would be on. This was before the spaceship book came out, so he borrowed pictures from other settings and some Kickstarter stuff. But we chose a spaceship and a financial balance and a theme because they sort of came together. We ended up taking a bounty hunter ship.
Cool.
it came with a brig and had a cool speeder on board that we could then drive around in on planet and could land everywhere because bounty hunter. So that sort of set the theme very early on, just based on, you know, the physical necessity of transportation. Because a spaceship is obviously not just like a car, it ends up being a house as well. And then we went to the life path system and made characters with the idea in mind that we would be playing mercenaries. And then the good thing about the life path system is that it gives you a certain flexibility of choice. So after we had talked, it was pretty clear that there were some roles that were going to need to be filled. So we had one person who ended up, based on his initial rolling and player preference, to make the jock meathead with the automatic weapon. One person who made the hacker, and one person who made the intelligence specialist. And I ended up playing the face of the group, the face and money man. So I was the pencil pusher, quote unquote. and that fell into place relatively quickly because the fiction of what we wanted to play had been established. I do want to say, though, that one thing that I experimented with, it was a one-shot, so take it for what it's worth, but was simply giving people the character generator tool, the life path system, and say, make me three characters and we'll make something out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, they were all humans. There are ways in the life path system to end up playing an alien, but it's really unlikely. And one of the main strengths in the core book is the life path system. It's expanded on in all of the extra books, but unfortunately the online tool that they built for it does not include all of the supplements, only some of them.
Okay.
But the narrative power of that engine cannot be underestimated. It does a lot for you.
Oh yeah.
Conversely, if you decide to abuse it, it is very open for abuse in terms of balance because the results you roll are not equal. Let's put it that way.
is always the same in character creation in role-playing games. The more options, the more cheesy players want to explore this, and more power gamers will appear on the scene. If the GM are not strict, or the players around the table are tightened around the power gamers' objectives in this. So that's, of course, there are so many options in Affinity, so many fractions and ideas to create this in through the life path system. So I tried to generate some characters online, and I was blown away how long it will take to create it. But there's a lot of options, and I didn't figure out all of them, of course. But as I said, the more options, the more cheese for the power gamers.
It's exceptionally well done, and even if you roll the bad results, you get a good story.
That's quite important. So we had in some of my campaigns, I had a player character who played a female pilot who had problems with her ex-husband, who is very rich and simply didn't accept the divorce. Also, that caused a lot of trouble. And the rule system, of course, give you the complication mechanic. So that could mean if you roll a complication during your mission, that bastard of your ex-husband shows up at an inopportune time. You can actually milk those life paths and what your characters get as a backstory for lots of events and lots of things. In recent campaign, one of the guys had a history as a smuggler, and the player actually managed to leverage the smuggler background and his contacts to circumvent a certain thing. We played a pre-made campaign, circumvent a certain problem, so that they found a shortcut due to things that happened in the background of the character. And this rich life path character creation is a thing I really miss for Conan also. Because Conan has a much more simplified life path, and that doesn't give you so much to work with. And in Infinity, you have even more than you actually probably could bring into play. It's such a rich life path for every single character.
I think one of the weirdest I've seen in the life path system, playing around with it, was that I rolled a male character, and then you roll people's backgrounds. You can choose to do that randomly. And I ended up having started out as a private investigator as my first career. And then for the second career, I was a militant member of a neo-Christian supremacist feminist group who didn't allow male members. I was sitting there looking up my character sheet going, there must have been some surgery involved, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, and regarding that, this is the transhumanism part. You can reliably switch gender or so, or actually sex, that means biological, all the time. You don't even need to get a new host, a new body. That could work too. In one of my campaigns, as an undercover agent, a male agent actually got himself transferred into a female host to actually better infiltrate a certain group. That worked quite well. This is a little bit like Altered Carbon or so. So that works quite well, and still you have weirdest cosmetic augmentations, not only on Bakunin but elsewhere too. So people can look the way they want to, run around as furries or whatever they like. The problem is, of course, if you have a furry-like cat girl character or so, which actually, in my experience, happened to be quite popular amongst some players. Now you have problems with some undercover things going on outside the furry community. That means if you want to simply slip into the mass of people and shadow someone, oh, that damn cat girl is behind me after 2 hours still, you stand out. So that's a problem, of course. Would you be sent on a kind of investigative mission if you look that way? I'm not quite sure. You have to talk with your players about that too. If they want to play, if you want to make a kind of secret agent, undercover cop or undercover agent campaign, characters that are standing out, obviously, that's a problem.
There are also some if you end up playing a non-human in the system, you also run into some weird limitations just because the aliens are strange. There's Pamestania has a subrace, which are actually sub-aquatic creatures.
The Halots.
Whose temperament and patience is determined by the amount of pressure around them, and if they're in 1G pressure, then they're basically berserk all the time. So they have to walk around in pressure suits in order to function in most habitats.
And of course, they are an oppressed racial minority. They are terrorists or kind of activists performing some attacks and activism. This is the same for the dog faces. The on Ariadne, there are some. This world has some kind of weird genetic effect on human beings. They could create some kind of hybrid between some kind of wolf-like creature and a human being. Those legendary werewolves, mention that.
Back to the werewolf.
But that's not a good thing, because they are, of course, outcasts of society. This is costs a lot of problems. There are people who actually hate them and hunt them. There are people who want to support them. So you get all your real-world minority problems in a fictional thing, and you could put them into play. So I find that interesting too.
Yeah, if you want your everyday common racism, that's obviously also there. But these are definitely played up.
But an important part you need to consider is what we didn't mention yet, Wilderness of Mirrors.
What do you got?
The Wilderness of Mirrors is the thing that you might actually work, for example, for O12, Bureau Noir, Secret Service, but you still come from one of the factions, major, minor, or so, and your loyalty is... That's the question. How loyal are you to the kind of UN Secret Service, or are you still loyal to your own faction? You will get side missions all the time. They know you are working, of course, now for the secret agent agency, and they have their own interest. And depending on the level of paranoia you want to have in your game, that could mean player versus player all the time, or it could be toned down to some side missions that don't jeopardize the actual mission goal. But you need to talk with your players about that too. How much player versus player do they want to? Because it could get really dirty if you crank that up to 11. No, to 5, it's already dirty.
Yeah, it's also a matter of the setting enforces some very, very strong incentives to not think that Space UN is all that great. A really good example that is actually from the board game is that the Space Knights, the Christian people, the reason they sign up is not necessarily that they're super duper Christian, but that if they survive being in service for a year, then they get a resurrection lottery ticket.
Yeah.
So everybody in the human sphere is entitled to resurrection, but the problem, because they had to do that about a century ago, because otherwise civil war, so there was a system put in place. The problem is some of these are chosen at random among the pool of increasingly growing dead people. So your chances get worse and worse. And then some of them were bought out by corporations or special interests. And the one organization in all of the human sphere that invested most money in being in control of resurrection was, of course, the Catholic Church. So
yeah, you can do good things and get some bonus towards your account regarding resurrection. So do good deeds and it will pay off, which is a very traditional Catholic thing.
Yeah,
actually, actually started the Reformation in the 1500s.
Yeah,
yeah.
It very much leans into that. And there's a character there in the board game who's compromised because he's not there for his own resurrection's sake. He plans to survive. But he does have a wife that he would like resurrected.
Yeah, brother cool. Constantinos. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So guys, when you sit down with a group and figure out what the purpose of the campaign is, because many role-playing games, the life path system are something from ancient times when from Traveller and from role-playing for Warhammer roleplay and so on. back in the '90s and the '80s, and a new wave of life paths have shown its beautiful or ugly face. What's where in the scale you want to see this? So you can create a character from randomness, but the newer games have been more fixed on what are we playing as a. For example, a good example is the new Alien RPG, where it's you as a player that get the story, not your character. And in Wesen, the Wesen RPG from Free League, it's more investigation. It's the players that have to figure out the clues and use the talents to figure out, and as in Gumshoe and so on. So there are some different play patterns from back in the Gygax times. What is this just a adventure group going out to be space pirates, or is there any special plate patterns that Infinity has to be aware of as a GM in this game?
So,
as a GM, I would say you have made the decision what kind of campaign you want to run. If you want a traveler-like campaign, you have a bunch of misfits of released from their services or so, and they are joining for whatever reason because they are friends or so and want to work together, you can go with that. That would be the most sandboxy thing to do. You don't know as a GM where this will develop. You have your characters and you start from there. But if you want to play a certain kind of corporate espionage game, for example, you need characters that are able to do that. So if you have your heavy weapons specialist who probably knows even blindfolded to disassemble and reassemble his HMG or so, that's fine. But that doesn't help you with some secretary who doesn't want to make an appointment for you.
Unless she's really impressed with your ability to disassemble and assemble your HMG in the middle of her office. Somehow.
Yeah. although, if you have a Maya channel, which is the kind of web there, and you have your videos about that, and the secretary might actually have seen that, and you're very famous and so on, you might actually bring that into play, and that could work out for you.
Yeah. Even weirder, if you have not just cameras installed, but full sensory stimulation, then she might have been you in a sensory dive. It's a weird conversation you run into sometimes.
Yeah, but the thing is, of course, it's not so set up that you have a certain type of actions that are expected. So in Wesen, you are investigating. It's not about combat, it's about knowing things, getting information about the weakness of the creatures, of what is happening. And this is that could be a thing in Infinity too, but you can have your mercenary group doing mercenary contracts, or you could have your bodyguards simply trying to get other people safely from A to B or so. This is such a huge setting, like Traveler. In Traveler, you can play the crew of a science ship and investigating some scientific anomalies or so, or you could play some kind of traders dealing with renitent patients and some cargo that is problematic. It depends on the campaign. So characters do what the campaign needs them to do. And sometimes if you have characters that don't fit that well, I had a group of four guys, I told them we need at least one face man. None of them created one, so that's fine. You have a target number of 8 in your best social ability. You live with it. And so they needed to get other ways to get some information because people simply weren't that cooperative when they tried to talk to them. That's fine. That's fine by me, but it's a, of course, walking complication then. You created your character to become a social complication. That could work too. But the recommendation was, of course, getting at least one face man in the group.
Yeah.
Invest some money in a geist that can pretend to be your face. That's always funny.
Yeah, but my question is more specific in Infinity. It's the ragtag band. The players are together. They're not changing up characters. They're not... leaning on to make cinematic scenes. It's more classic role playing as a group and as a function that there's a DM, there is some players, and they have to solve something in a sandbox campaign or in a tight campaign.
Hold on.
So there's no extra things to know if you want to pick up this game as a DM.
That's not quite accurate, actually.
Yep. Okay.
Because the game operates with a momentum system.
That's system wise. We can take that in a second.
Yes.
But
the entire concept is that, and you have this in most settings, I suppose. But mm-hmm. but the more successful you are, the more weird things you can do, and you do get stats. Again, talking about the crunch, called superhuman X, and one of the things you can have a superhuman personality. And when you start to lean into stats like that, you start to do things that are frankly superhuman. Yes, you walk into the bank and convince them to pay you $1 million for having a pretty face, I guess. You can definitely take it in that direction, and the system does support it. It even leans into it sometimes with some of the concepts. But it is an active choice, and some of these, let's call them upgrades, either require some very specific roles on your life path, but you can force those. You get points where you can decide what your roles, if you know where they are, you can just take them. Or they require a lot of money to buy later on. But this kind of heroic-centric, very, very dramatic description play is absolutely contained in the system, but if you do it, then you should probably have all players on the same page.
Yeah, and that plays into the Wilderness of Mirrors thing. That probably won't happen in a mercenary game or in a trader campaign or so, because all will have the same goal. But the default campaign is, of course, the O12 Bureau Noir, the Secret Service campaign. That actually gets folks from very different backgrounds in the same group. They are supposed to work together. And let's consider a very low paranoia level. That means they are not always working against each other, not all the time player versus player thing. They have to rely on each other to actually successfully complete their mission. They have to rely on each other's skills. So you have the typical A-team-like approach. You have folks that are working together. They might actually have some differences, but still they are working together. And this is I think this O12 Bureau Noir default campaign was created or suggested to make this work, because you can get characters from very disparate, different backgrounds. And why would they work together? Oh yeah, O12, they actually recruited everyone and now they have to. That makes things easier for the GM in this regard. But for other campaigns, I would really recommend creating characters that fit together in the first place.
Yeah. So they have a common goal, so they're not stabbing each other in the back from the beginning and so on.
And you still might have your personal goals. You still might, in a mercenary campaign, you still might have a personal goal to get out of there, to get the great contract with a good paying job, and then your own thing or whatever. This is still a thing of the personal goal of the character, but it's not so easy. I mentioned the twists. So you might start up with a corporate espionage, and then you find yourself in a kind of space race setting. And then you find yourself on an ice world in a combat setting where you get shot from three parties that you never knew before. So be prepared for everything.
Yeah, for sure. The system, let's take that, guys. The system is the 2d20 game from Modiphius. There's a lot of different, a different version of this game, and I have been on the podcast later this week. And I have to talk to him about how the different games are constructed. So, if you want to listen about 2d20 games as a general, pick up that episode for sure. But guys, how did this system this version of 2D20 games fit into Affinity, Nils? How did you experience this?
First of all, it needs to be said that the game is extremely crunchy compared to what little I have experienced about the 2D20 systems. There's a lot of rules, there's a lot of tables. You get rules for what kind of rifle you have, where it has been manufactured, how it has been upgraded, what kind of ammunition you've put in it, and then of course there's also your training, which is on your character sheet. So you can get very, very specific. And then that's paired with a combat system that operates with abstract zones that are sort of indeterminate systems of range. So you get very, very detail oriented when designing things, and then when you use them, when you're in actual combat, you go into a more narrative mode because things are abstract, and sometimes a zone is 50 meters in a crowd, and sometimes it's 2 kilometers of open terrain, I guess. And it kind of makes a difference on how far your sniper rifle will shoot, because it counts zones and not kilometers.
You found one of the most disturbing aspects you find in 2D20 games. The zone idea is good and fine for the more abstract things like Dune or other rather low detailed mechanics. But for Mutant Chronicles and for Infinity, those are the two oldest ones and the most crunchiest 2D20 games. You get lots of gun porn, lots of stats for and fiddly bits for your weapons, and then you get only ranges like close, medium, long, which are arbitrarily defined by the GM, how the GM sets up the scene. It doesn't work together that well, although you don't mind if you're not that much into firefights. But if you play a mercenary game, for example, I would say having a sniper rifle should make much more of a difference than it does with the zone system.
There are other things where similar problems come into effect. One of my favorite examples was that I was playing the Money Man, so obviously I had to make myself immortal. And you do this by installing a specific cybernetic upgrade, which is called a hyper-threading something-something blah, into your artificial body. And then it takes about half a year, and your consciousness has been uploaded to the internet, and Google is now permanently your friend because you just moved in. And that is detailed fairly well in the rules. This is what the item costs. This is how difficult it is to install an already existing body. This is how long the upload takes. This is the rule you make not to go insane, so on and so forth. And then there's the question of, right, so I got there. Cool, I am now immortal. How does that work? Oh, okay. No rules for that. Fair enough. I won then.
You mentioned you're rich, you could acquire that. This is another of the problems. The abstract acquisition system, that's in some way fine because you don't need to bookkeep lots of different actually currencies, because there's not the typical Traveler Imperium's credit that is accepted everywhere. So you have lots of different currencies and weird currencies like the social energy that is used on the Nomad motherships, for example. This is abstracted in a way of acquisition rules. So you have a kind of a damage that any acquisition does to your cash flow. But the problem is that allows a character who not even maxed out, who has a decent lifestyle, it's the skill for acquisitions, has a decent acquisition skill, to buy up a tag, which is probably a military-only thing. A tag is the kind of battle mech version that's used in Infinity. And, that would be like, I'm quite rich. I go to the next used tanks dealership and buy some Abrams tanks or so. Three for the price of two or so.
That's kind of worse. But, yeah.
It's actually worse. Yeah, it's worse. And the problem is, player characters could easily acquire insane things, and that could actually break a whole group, because you might actually end up with a character who has problems buying a pair of new shoes, and the other one is buying a luxury space yacht every other day.
I had a group of players where I sat down and said, okay, play around with this character generator, see how broken it is if you know how the system works. And that would be really difficult with the books, because it's not explained as a coherent whole that's easy to overlook. But once you get the generator in front of you, it's much easier to understand what's going on, because the computer does all of the weird calculations for you.
Yep.
And I got a former Hakislam concubine that had been genetically modified to have superhuman personality, who then defected and became a grey market trader. So we're dealing with somebody who's rolling pretty much the maximum amount of dice that they can in acquisitions, with some additional successes for the cybernetics and modifications, and who has an earnings rating of 9 out of 7. Yes, it's possible to break through the theoretical maximum. It's weird.
There's no upper limit, actually. That's insane. Yeah,
they just stop describing how rich you are after level 7. Yeah. It's like, yeah, the skill continues up. Have fun. And it was at the point where she was able to buy cybernetic upgrades that made her better than a starting character focused on fighting at fighting, without spending money.
Yeah, this without spending money means
without taking damage from their equipment.
You have a base difficulty you need in successes on your lifestyle skill test. That difficulty is capped at 5. So 5 is the highest difficulty you will ever need to roll in the 2d20 system. And a character that is maxed out, especially with superhuman personality, which adds successes, this is not difficult at all. It means you will, of course, find someone who will sell this thing to you. And if you have a high earnings, this won't actually affect your cash flow that much, so you don't care. And you buy something like that next day again, because you have the money. And so you could actually upgrade your character in ways that are quite insane. And this is a thing the GM needs to take a look at. There are some things like that in the rules system on the upper end of ability. As I said, Mutant Chronicles characters start much less competent, and they don't get this insane race in competency. But if you play Infinity characters with 10,000 or one of the current campaigns is about 12,000 XP per character, they are very, very, very competent. So it's hard to challenge them.
Yeah, so you have to construct, if you use the system as it's written, you have to be aware of a lot of things as a GM to make the characters not stupidly badass. So as you said, they cannot be challenged in combat, so you have to challenge them in other ways and so on. But still you have to be aware of this if you want some. If you are playing a mercenary band, combat should be one of the way to pressure the group in some capacity. And you, as you said, and then also you said you can break the system money wise and then be immortals, as you said.
Yeah.
So the crunch in this system, are this enough for a lot of tech fans in your perspective, Frank? Especially, you have tried a lot of other sci-fi games like in Traveller, or have you played Shadowrun and Cyberpunk? A lot of the draws in those systems are the tech and the crunchiness, and find the small notches and to turn. How do you find this system good enough for those?
Such a system which relies on a lot of equipment, or offers a lot of equipment, has always a kind of materialistic approach to solve problems. So in other systems, you take the equipment as given and use the skills. So what your character is able to do is depending on the character's stats. In this case, to some degree, But the good choice, the choice of the best equipment for the current job, the current task, is important. So player characters who are into that, into the material side of equipment, they get offered quite a lot. Every single sourcebook has long lists of new equipment, and you can do weird stuff with that. I was surprised by some problems solved by very creative application of some, even in the core book, of some equipment there. I think it will challenge the ingenuity of the players to choose the right tools for the right task, and if they don't have the right tools, to make do with whatever they have in a creative way. That works quite well. Infinity offers that a lot. That said, there are some choices, especially with the hacking devices and the programs, that are no-brainers, that are always better than others. So you, as a GM, you still have to be careful that player characters might optimize in a way that makes them do the same thing all the time because they are simply the best choice for everything. So that is with some hacking devices, that is with some programs, and some weapons too. Of course, the Tizium Chopper, which is an iconic weapon for characters from Ariadne also, this is always one of the best close combat weapons you can get. The armor piercing is so insanely high, you will chop down a tank or a tag or so all the time. So you have to be careful that things are not boring in that way. One way I deal with it is, and this is a thing that's lacking in some of the source books, but not in all of the adventures, in pre-made adventures, what kind of weapons are you actually allowed to carry? So if you come with, from a circular, these huge space trains that are traveling the wormholes, get by shuttle to a kind of a spaceward port from a space elevator and want to get down to the planet side. And you walk around with your heavy machine gun, your power armor, and your Tizium chopper. No. Simply no. If you don't belong to a military unit, you might have those in a sealed container somewhere and sent to you. That might work. But you don't walk around armed to the teeth in a civil surrounding. So you have, so as a GM, so you have to present the setting in a plausible way. And you don't want to have in civil society lots of armed people with loaded guns and even worse weapons.
Yeah. So when you want to confine the players not to be power gaming equipment-wise and tech-wise, you use the settings parameters to uphold this this contract or this meta contract with your players actually. And
yeah.
How do you look at this this system tech wise, Nils? Is this satisfying for your tech heart?
So I approach tech from a very different angle from what Frank presented us, because I'm weird. I like technology that enables stories. So to me, science fiction technology is interesting because it enables us to do stuff we couldn't in the real world. It is the parallel to magic in a fantasy world. But cooler, because it's not magic. Wait. and Infinity has a lot to offer there. There's a lot of nitty-gritty with what kind of ammunition you put into your rifle. And for some reason, normal ammunition and armor-piercing ammunition goes in the same rifles. So you never really buy normal ammunition, because why would you? except if the security guard asks whether you're using armor-piercing ammunition, then you might be in trouble. So yeah. In a lot of the, I want to optimize my gear in order to be best in combat, there are a lot of no-brainer choices. And unfortunately, the same holds true for armor, the same holds true for cybernetics. If you start looking into artificial bodies, you run into the problem that the more you modify a body, the less each modification costs, which mm-hmm. gets to be stupid.
Yeah, it seems like that.
Yeah.
I can remember in the old Shadowrun 4th edition, 3rd edition, there is a balance between you have the great have two kinds of neuro combat, sort of like wire combat thing that was the choice. The one was really good, but the other one can be upgraded 3 times, and if you upgrade it the third time, it's a lot better than the cheap version, but you cannot upgrade the first version of it. I can't remember what they're called, but I love that those choices in a, especially with tech and sci-fi, that the players have to take some hard choices in the system, and that's maybe some of the places they want to improve.
They have tried to do it.
Editor.
They've tried to do it because there's an availability rating. On top of what things cost, you have to actually find people who are willing to sell them to you. And if you're like, I want to buy a space dreadnought, then the amount of people who have such things on hand, not currently serving in the military, who can just sort of sell them on the spot are kind of limited.
Although maxed out stats regarding lifestyle also might actually make that feasible for any character. So that's one of the things where acquisition rules are a little bit wonky.
Yeah, that's a problem. And it's a problem because you can break the system by simply overpowering these barriers. But they are there. And for a lot of the really, really attractive technology that are specific to factions because they have monopolized them because it's part of their power, you get a discount if you are from that faction. So if you want to be a silk trader, then being a Hack Islam character will make that more feasible for you. But otherwise, it's really expensive whenever you
buy. I found that very interesting. That gives you a sense of belonging to a certain faction. Yeah. I like that in Mutant Chronicles too. They have even worse acquisition system. But if you, for example, if you belong to the Bauhaus faction there and you buy Bauhaus stuff, it's cheaper for you and it's of course of better quality than the cheap ass capital stuff. and so the thing is that gives you the discount per faction gives you a sense of I'm from Yuxing. I get these cool Yuxing things. I
come
like
with
that.
Cameras that survey me all the time, but that's cool.
Ah, come on, who cares? I mean, you do have a Maya, you do have a MayaNet account anyway, so Alef is always listening in.
Yeah.
Anyway,
But the system wise, it's a 2-20 game. What do you like this? Is this a great system for this game? It's because some of the other 2D20 games are very pulpy. Fallout, Conan, as we talked about earlier, Frank, and of course Actum Cthulhu, which are the most pulpy of the games, I think. Star Trek is also a bit pulpy, and Dune is just weird because it's not pulpy for me at all.
Yeah, well, it's Dune. It should be weird.
Yeah, but it's not pulpy weird. But that's another talk. Is this too pulpy, the system, or too heroic for this kind of setting? Because one of my draws for Dead in Space, the Dead in Space setting I loved, and a mothership and an alien, that it's so lethal, it's so hard to survive as a human in this world. Is this system maybe too much Actum Cthulhu and too little realism?
No, but... Okay. But, and this is important, the game offers a lot of conditional bonuses that if you have the kinds of players who overprep everything, then they will annihilate anything you put in front of them. A really good example is, this is a really, really cheap item in the equipment list, you can get a makeup box that allows you to put on traditional makeup to appeal to a particular culture. So if you know you're going into a business meeting and you're going to have to convince the Chinese employer that he should pay you more, then obviously you go out and you acquire this really cheap item. The crux, of course, is that you have to know that you need it. And there are a lot of things like that. So if you're playing the kind of game where your players have all the time to set it up correctly, then I really hope in your description as a GM you make them feel like freaking James Bond. Because that's what their dice balls are going to be. Yeah.
As they should be. It's if you play the secret agent thing, what players often ask, can we get this item? Can we get that item? What's our loadout for this mission? Usually you don't get that much upfront from O12 because they are financially quite cut short. As with the UN, the participating nations, the G5 nations in the human sphere, yeah, they reluctantly pay for O12 services. And not always on time, and not always in the agreed upon amount. And so the secret service you're working for is always short on the money. So you have to make do with things what you get, and maybe acquire things in the field by your own ingenuity. And this is the thing. If you have time to plan ahead, if you know what you're facing or so, I like that for the big finale of some campaign or at least some mission or so. If players have now know what's it about and can acquire the decent tools for the job they expect, that's fine, and they should have the success they get from that. But often they get thrown into a situation where things are never as they seem. And you have to make do with whatever you have. So they are struggling, of course. They are finding solutions for problems and causing other problems. But I think Infinity is not about killing off your player characters. Alien is the new blue color space games. There are a few out there. They are about simply offing the player characters. This is a very old school thinking now in space. The thing is, in old school fantasy or so, OSR fantasy, simply eliminating total particle like groups, that's a trope that's been around for decades. But I find that considering the rich background of every single character in Infinity, it's cutting short all the great stories you might actually put them through if you simply want to kill them off. That's not only the easy way out, that's actually the way to ruin your own campaign. I mean, you can screw around with your player character's background all the time without killing them. You could make their life to hell, like the ex-husband of one of the characters I described earlier. That guy is rich and shows up everywhere. And he knows where you are. Shit, how would you deal with that? You cannot simply kill him. Of course you could. Do you? See, that's the kind of problem.
Yeah. What the system does really well, and the tech thing actually works into this, is that it is really good at making the players feel like they are being affected by a world that works on scale. And as long as they know what's going on, and as long as that corporation is prepared for what's coming, they can play that game, and they might even beat it sometimes. But when they meet stuff they're not prepared for, when something unexpected happens, when their servers are hacked, whatever it is, that's when the game then gets interesting.
Yeah, that's what I meant with it starts as corporate investigation, and then you find yourself hunted by werewolves on a jungle planet. Damn it.
Back to that.
You have to
freaking jungle planet again. Okay. Some part of the 2D20 games are the momentum some we touched on that earlier. Can we have some formulation about this, because that's some special for the 2D20 games. There's a lot of different ways to use it in the different systems. How do you use it when you are GMing, Frank and Nils? What are your experiences about it? So can you guys formulate anything?
I would like to point out that Infinity was the second in the line of the 2D20 games. So Mutant Chronicles was the first one, and the GM resource, they're called Dark Symmetry Points, is called Heat in Infinity. They work differently, actually decidedly differently to the Dark Symmetry Points, and the whole momentum thing is working differently too. Slightly then, of course, the thing is, in development, you see a kind of line where things changed from Mutant Chronicles over Infinity to Conan. Infinity has damage dice, which add a fixed value to your dice roll and have less symbols for the effects on each die. That means in Conan, you could roll 8 dice of damage and everything comes up blank. You won't do a point of damage. In Infinity, you always do at least the fixed value. So that's quite different. And the Nathan Dowder, the main developer of the 2D20 line, he actually said he did change that to Conan, and he prefers the latter part. In Achtung Cthulhu, you only have those damage dice, so you don't have the fixed value. I actually prefer the fixed value plus the variable dice, but this is a matter of taste. But the main point for the heat spans, in Mutant Chronicles, as a GM, you couldn't simply enter whatever surplus successes you wrote for your NPCs to your dark symmetry pool. That would require certain special abilities of the NPCs. In Infinity, as in Conan, if your NPCs have good success, have some additional successes that more than they needed, you could add that to your heat pool, which is very good to give you the amount of heat points you need to activate their special effects and to bolster your NPCs to make things more interesting for your player characters. And player characters can, of course, still have their momentum spans that are well known from Conan and from Mutant Chronicles. But in this case, you still have the old costs. That means one additional d20 for your dice pool costs one momentum, the second one only 1 point, and the third one only 1 point. In the later games, like Star Trek or so, the second one would cost 2 points, and the third one cost 3 points. That makes quite a bit of a difference. I introduced that in... I ran two campaigns at the moment. I introduced that in the other campaign, and I found the whole dice pool size is a bit lower, it's more manageable, and it's a bit easier to challenge the player characters, even if they are already experienced. So I can recommend using that rule, the more recent one, compared to the old one, where you get one die for 1 point of heat or 1 point of momentum. So that was 1 point.
So Nils, how did you use it? And maybe some of the cool things for me in Memento is that the players are with you as a GM to create the story in the scene.
Yeah. So there are a few mechanics that are really interesting. I think the first time I discovered this weird rule use for momentum was in Space Combat, where somebody had to be the captain. And as we all know, it's kind of questionable what the captain actually does. for any Star Trekkie out there. But what it does in Infinity is that if you're captaining the ship, then you get to make a roll. I think it's a command roll off the top of my head. And each success you get on the roll adds a momentum that you can then hand out to the rest of the crew directing them.
Yeah.
And I can't recall exactly how. I didn't focus on combat much. But you can, but you can do the same in sort of squad level combat by giving directions. So momentum becomes a way for a non-combat character to sort of have this influence on what everybody else is doing. That was interesting because it meant that some characters we had along, including some pencil pushers, NPCs, were suddenly quite relevant because they had eyes on, okay, you need to watch that sniper position over there, so don't go out of cover, and blah. That gave some bonuses. Then, because I had a fairly well-prepared GM, hooray, momentum was immediately usable in a lot of investigation situations to unlock not necessarily mission critical information, but background information that would be important to the grander plot. Okay, this company over here has been hired to fuck us up and falsify our flight records, so we'll get stopped by spaceport security, whatever. You can find that out with a normal success, but then as you started to unlock more and more with momentum, because your role went well,
This is very, very important because many campaigns that are focusing on investigation, you have to remember the base difficulty is often only a single success, but there's often more information to be had if you spend momentum on that. Other games actually raise the difficulty, make things more difficult, or higher DC also in Pathfinder also to get more information. And in Infinity, You investigate something, you get more momentum out of that roll, and you spend that. And it's a useful spend. It's never wasted. So that's a very important thing if you go for investigation games or campaigns.
Yeah. It also means that the concept of a failure, I mean, okay, you can fail your roll. Of course it happens. But by and large, the concept of success and failure is way less binary. Because you got some information, but did you get the information you needed? Okay, this corporation has been hired to screw us up. Who hired them? I'm hitting an ice wall. Okay, shit. So that used by a candy GM is a really, really useful tool. And sometimes it's these application in combat as well. There's one function in combat that I want to point out as a blight on game balance, namely that the ability piercing is way too easy to access. Basically, piercing allows you, whenever you roll a 6 on your damage die, to subtract 2 from the enemy's armor. That sounds bad, but it's actually kind of worse when you then realize that your power armor has a total armor rating where it's the most heavily armored of 4. So very, very often, these momentum spends can very quickly take away, because you can also buy piercing for momentum, can very quickly take away the effect of armor. I think we got
regarding this piercing, it's a free momentum spend, so you don't need even a piercing weapon. Only if you have a weapon with ammo or so which has the piercing ability, the number of effects counts for piercing ability, but you could always spend one momentum for 2 points of piercing. So if you have a hit with 2 momentum, spend those 2 for piercing and you ensure that you will hurt your enemy.
Yeah. And even if he's in a tag, like the really, really, really heavily armored of them. Okay, the Jotun has 10. But otherwise, a heavily armored tag is 8. So on a good roll, you trivially just ignore armor.
Yeah.
It's quite frustrating in terms of game balance. And our player who tried to play the gun-chucking heavy machine gun guy in power armor found himself very, very quickly gunned down by a few people with armor-piercing pistols.
Yeah,
and that's just sort of a weird mechanic that they probably could have thought better.
Yeah, but there's something else in combat that I found a little bit even more disturbing. This is a thing the same in Conan. NPCs act after all the PCs have acted, and the problem is you need to muster up hordes of NPCs because they will get mowed down before they even be able to act. If you use this type of initiative, this is not the case for space combat or so. Shipboard combat works in alternating in initiative, so player character side, NPC side, then again player character side. But for personal combat, it's like in the Conan game, player characters act first. So that has the adverse effect of prompting the GM to send in the clowns, the clones, actually, because you have to send in some characters that will get eliminated before you actually get to act for your NPCs. And I introduced in one of my campaigns the alternating initiative rule that is was introduced in Star Trek, and that works much better. Each side only gets one character to act his turn, and then the other character gets to act their turn, and so on. That works much better. That gives the NPCs a chance and makes the number of NPCs in a scene much smaller, and that is actually more plausible. In Conan, it's even unplausible to actually mow down 40 opponents all the time. You depopulate whole areas. It's a low-tech society, so they probably won't grow back soon. So you actually depopulate the whole area. And in Infinity, Even with a high population density, you probably don't want to promote genocide all the time.
Here come the player characters, pull out the cloning mats. I'd forgotten it actually worked like that, because everybody who backed the Kickstarter and got the base book took one look at the Copter Combat section and was immediately like, no, we're not doing that.
It does work for combat situations on a smaller scale. If you're not so much focusing on combat, on a mercenary campaign, I would think you run much more into problems than on an investigative campaign.
Yeah, We played investigating mercenaries, but the problem was that not only were we playing mercenaries, we also had remotes working for us in the field at the same time. So giving a full turn to everything and the kitchen sink was a lot of destructive power.
Oh yeah, that's another thing. Remotes, some kind of drones or so, they belong to the setting. They are very iconic. There are lots of iconic types of remotes. And even the starting PC might actually have a Tinbot, which is quite useful if you upgrade that. And every character has a Geist too, which is a kind of virtual limited AI, which you can upgrade to quite a bit of competency. So if it works in a common way, every single player character could have their own remote and their Geist, so you have three characters for one player already.
Or you could just upgrade the Geist to be really good at shooting and then have it inhabit the remote, and then you have a combat monster that's more powerful than the character behind it.
Yeah, as a player, I do that all the time. It's really nice.
So there are some ways where the combat system is not... Actually, there are a lot of ways where the combat system is not great.
It gets glossed over in that regard, because many of the inspirational media have been anime and so on. So you want this kind of anime, high octane action, and that is what the designers of the miniatures game were going for, and I think they achieved that. And the role-playing game does achieve that even better. I find the role-playing game player characters are quite tough, quite competent, and they look like the stars of an anime series.
This is true. I did mention Ghost in the Shell.
Yes, for bringing it all the way around. So guys, we have touched on some of the things you want to improve or ignore when you are DMing this or playing this. So I think this concurs our talk tonight.
Wait! I might want to add something. We didn't mention a thing where we don't complain all the time, because we have been whining a lot.
Whining a lot.
The life path gives every character from different events traits, personal traits. They are similar to in Fate to aspects. You could use them positively or negatively, and those are actually making the character in a way very interesting to act. You can always play on a trait as a player to get an infinity point. If you fail some action due to this trait, you can always say, we have some, for example, you have a nomad character who is afraid of the vacuum. He's on a spaceship or even on a space station. He's always under fear, and that is, of course, that makes him actively fail some things, like jumping from an airlock to a ship or so, and he gets an infinity point for that. This is a reward for failing, and this gives the player the choice to design the story in a more complicated way for his character. The character probably don't want to fail, but the player wants to, and I find that is a very, very interesting aspect. And as a GM, you could spend some heat and activate this trait in an inopportune moment where the player thinks he's now in a very safe and controlled situation, and all of a sudden his trait plays up and no longer in control. This makes things interesting. This is a powerful tool which is underplayed in Mutant Chronicles a little bit, and much more underplayed in Conan. And I like that this is in Infinity a very major thing for the characters to have. Every character has a list of traits, and you might actually acquire during a campaign a few more. So that is a thing I really wanted to mention.
It also encourages players to play to fail. I have seen players let their characters get killed over these traits just because it leaned into a cinematic moment. I think we had a Japanese samurai character who was honorable and would not withdraw from combat, so of course he had to charge that HMG, make a new character. But they're funny tools, because you're giving the player the opportunity to play their character down, and then you're rewarding them for doing it.
Yeah. Cool. So we're ending this on a positive note, guys. So that's but I think everybody that listened to this all the way, the 2 hours we have talked on this this great game and this great setting, and Nils or Frank, you have to hook me up for a game someday, so we can play something together. Is there anything else you want to enlighten us with, or do you have anything to add?
Yeah, a little bit. The thing is, the last two books for the Infinity line have been published, the last two books that had been financed by the Kickstarter, and there are lots of rumors that the product line is now at an end. There's nothing new announced for Infinity, so it might actually be the last time to actually get your hands on everything Infinity. I can recommend doing that. There might be bundles in the next few months or so, like they did with Mutant Chronicles, and it's a great game, and I can really, really recommend getting that if you're interested in science fiction games without the supernatural stuff going on.
Wakehorse Belly does it. I know there's a Modifius publishing them, but the way
it's Modifius.
Yeah, I know. But the way Corvus Belli usually does this is that if they have a single product, then they'll have a last sale. And they'll announce it.
Yep.
I imagine they'll do similar here.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Thanks for Frank for doing this, guys. It was a great talk. Mostly you did the talking, and I tried to put you inside the outline. So thanks for this, guys.
Very welcome.
You're good. Yep.
Thanks to Frank and Nils to talk to us about the Infinity. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Next week we want to touch on the Mirkbow role-playing game, the aesthetically beautiful and great OSR game with Johan, which are one of the game designers for the game. Follow us on Facebook, GM Workshop, the podcast. If you want to interact with us and talk to us, give us a message.